property or have a portion of it, or have a portion of it in low income, then we will give you a tax credit of anywhere from 50 to 100% of the taxes for X amount of years. So that means your annual tax bill comes in, and if it's a 50% tax credit for 5 years, for the first 5 years, you're only paying 50% of the taxes. If it's 100%, it would be 100% of the taxes for the first 5 years. So I'll give you, for instance, the city of Cleveland was giving out a 75% tax credit for 10 years to get people to renovate inner city properties. And then what happened was nobody was doing it. Everybody was moving out of Cleveland. So they offered 100% for 15 years, and they started getting some real momentum with that. So that's one of the things that helped change that market, plus job growth. So what he's saying is he's got some tax credits that he will forward to the next buyer, if that will help the deal out. The other thing with tax credits is typically they last for 15 years. Okay, so you make a 15-year commitment in order to provide low-income housing or have, you know, the rents controlled rents for that period of time. But at the end of the 15 years, you're free. You're free to go to market. So if you buy now at year 10 and there's 5 years remaining on the tax credits and on the commitment for low-income housing or lower rent, you know, then not only it seems like you'll get tax credits for buying this property, but also an opportunity in 5 years to actually bring that property to market, which is usually a big windfall. So we do have an operator on the line right now, I understand. Yes, who's the operator today?
Hi, my name's Roshana. I'll be an operator for today's call.
Hi, Roshana. So Roshana's on, and what to do now is to press star zero if you'd like to ask a question. We'll answer the questions as they come in. So press star zero, and Roshana will put you in the queue to ask your questions. While you're going into the queue, I am going to answer a couple more questions. This next one comes from Mark Magnuson from Palm Harbor, Florida. Do you have experience using crowdfunding sites to fund deals? I know some people are not fans of crowdfunding, and I want to get your opinion. Well, I haven't found a crowdfunding site that actually works. Somebody actually mentioned one on a call, and I wrote it down, and I forget what it was. But when they first started coming out, I was really excited because, you know, if you can get crowdfunding for a deal, you know, depending upon how much they're going to charge you for that crowdfunding, that would be really, really exciting. And what I found was there was a lot more lenders on those crowdfunding sites posing as investors. And the reason I found them out was I started getting asked for tax returns. And I said, do you mean profit and loss statements? And they said, oh, no, we want to see your tax returns. And I said, well, why would you want to see my tax returns if you're going to become an equity partner on the deal? You would only really need to see the profit and loss statements of the property to determine whether or not you want to make the investment. They said, well, you know, just to get more comfortable with the deal, we'd like to see your tax returns. And I'm thinking, I've never been asked this before from any investor, whether it be a private equity guy or even an individual investor. And I said, I'm not going to do it. And then I come to find out later that it was a debt partner, not an equity partner, somebody that was looking to give debt on the deal. And that came out several times during interviews with people who said they were, quote-unquote, wanted to be equity partners on the deal. So I haven't found one to date that works. But if anybody out there has, please come on the call and share it with us if you've actually used one or know somebody that's used one and have gotten it. I'd be interested to know what the fees are too, what they took from the deal in order to get the deal done for you. All right, I'll take one more. As everybody's queuing up, Julie writes in. She says, what steps does one take to verify that a recent increase is possible on a property you're underwriting? For example, if a broker represents that rents at a property are under market by, say, 10% per square foot, how can we best confirm to our investors that potential renters will pay this increase, especially if it makes these units more expensive in the area because these units are the largest? So the first thing you got to do is you've just got to determine who your competition is going to be, all right? And your competition are properties that are built within the same time frame as yours, that have the similar amenities as yours, and are laid out like yours. And that are within a couple of miles of yours. So what you're going to do there is you're going to visit those properties and you're going to do what's called the rent survey. And you're going to, first of all, take a look at the property and find out what they have that you don't, what you have that they don't. And then you can find out what their rents are, what their going rents are right there at the market. And that will tell you whether or not your rents are below market or at market. That's the only way to do it. Don't rely on any other website to do it for you. Don't rely on any broker's information. Just know that you've got to determine what's comparable first, and then go to those comparable properties and find out what they're offering by walking them. You can always say, you know, you're in town, you're going to be transferred. I always told them, I was in construction, I was being transferred, and I'd like to see the 1 and 2 bedroom units. And they usually have model apartments that they'll show you, and you can get a good idea of what they're offering. So that's how you do it. All right, and hey, by the way, when you're doing your underwriting for your deals and you have brokers that tell you that you can raise the rents by X amount, check out what comps they use, because more often than not, we're finding that brokers are using properties that were built earlier, meaning more recently, than the property that is in question. And in that case, you can't get a higher, you can't compare them to those properties. You won't get those higher rents. So, all right, let's open up the line. Let's open up the wisecracker line and find out who's our first caller. Who's our first caller on this beautiful, beautiful Boston afternoon? It's about 95 degrees out there today. Woo! Summer is here. They just turned on the switch. You know, in Boston, it was a rainy, cold, rainy spring, and that lasted right into mid-June. And now, 2 days ago, they turned on the switch, and now summer is here. Sweet. All right, who's first?
Our first question comes from Anita. Anita, please state your question.
Hi, Dave. Welcome to summer.
Hey, thank you very much. Yeah, I need some key lime pie now.
Your switch went on, ours went off in sunny Northern California with 60s this weekend and windy and chilly, so not fun. But,
wow, no cookouts there.
No, it's crazy. So I got several questions. I'm getting ready to hopefully submit my purchase agreement today.
Yeah.
For a little property in North Carolina. And
All right.
It's been an interesting ride as I have went back and forth with the LOI and got to agreeable terms. And then I put in an offer to purchase, which I got from, you know, the forms, and they said, no, they don't want that. They want a regular purchase sales agreement. I said, okay. So I went to your website, looked at that. I talked to another student, looked at hers, and then passed it by Anderson, and they said, well, it's a North Carolina property, so you should probably use a North Carolina contract. So my first question is, do you normally use a contract for the state with which you're buying a property? Is that standard or not so much?
Yeah, I have an attorney from that state provide me with that contract.
Okay. So I've got that, and so I filled that out. And then it had two addendum clauses. One is like a lead-based paint, which I think I automatically fill that out because it's just, you know, basically a, say, you know, check for lead paint. But the other one, which is a weird one, and this is going to be seller financed, is a seller finance addendum. And I Googled that, and the only ones I can find are either password protected or they are have a sample stamped on them. So do you know why that is?
A seller finance addendum?
Yeah. It's called a Form 2A5-T.
Why, is the seller providing financing?
Yeah. And the North Carolina contract has
How come
that,
you're not
so
using
I
an attorney?
Know. Huh?
Why aren't you using an attorney?
Well, I am.
Well, the attorney will draw that up for you.
Okay, but is it weird that it has the form like that that's like kind of protected without an attorney? Is that why?
To be honest with you, I'm not sure. I've never searched the internet for forms, legal forms, because you know the reason you hire a local attorney is because they know the little innuendos that will get you in each of those contracts. So that's why it's always smart to get an attorney. To it's going to cost money, but you know you're going to save a lot more in the long run by not getting got by some clause that you didn't even realize. But sometimes it's only one or two words. You know, and those words are against you.
Okay. Okay, well, that makes sense, because I just never, you know, it's my first time, so I've never run across that in any other thing that I've looked at or any of your training. And another thing, a question for you, just a general question, is do you feel like if just for a general multi-unit property, is it necessary to put it in a land trust or just an LLC?
Oh, say that again.
When you buy a property,
yeah.
Do you think it's fine just to keep it in an LLC, or do you put it in a land trust and then the LLC within the land trust?
The only time I've ever used a land trust was for a smaller property, like 3 to 6 units. Otherwise, you want an LLC.
Okay, and why then versus a bigger one? What would you need one for a smaller property?
Because you lose a lot more on the bigger ones, and it costs you $1,500 a year to run that. Well, it costs you $1,500 for the LLC, and it costs you $500 a year for the filing fees, whereas a trust, you can set it up yourself. That's one thing. You can take a course and learn how to do it yourself and set it up yourself, and it doesn't cost you anything.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you, Dave.
You're welcome. Good luck out there.
Thank you.
Okay, who's next?
Up next, we have Christy. Christy, please state your question.
Hi, good morning, Dave. This is Christy from San Francisco.
Hey, how are you? Did you get cold, rainy weather too?
Oh, no, it's getting sunny. It's good. Good weather.
So, what, you're from San Francisco, is that what you said?
Yes.
Do you ever eat at that Asian restaurant at the bottom of Chinatown? I think it's called Something 88, where, you know the park there?
The park
in Chinatown in San Francisco. So if you're looking at the park from the hotel, I think there's a Hilton at the bottom there, and you take a left, and then like one block down on the corner, there's a restaurant.
Is that a dim sum restaurant?
In the world. No, it's not dim sum. It's full.
Oh.
But they see people downstairs. But they have the best beef in the world. It's like the house special beef. Oh, my God, it's so good. We get it every time we go there.
Huh. Okay, I should try next time. But I know there's a very good crab restaurant. Like, it's the best crab, you know, with all the news reporter. They have to go there and try it.
Where's that? What's it called?
I forgot what it's called, but it's at the corner of it's very close to that restaurant you're talking about, like the parking garage.
Oh, really?
And that boat. And, yeah.
All right. Let's check it out. So what's going on in your world?
So just questions about the 1031 exchange. So I know a couple people who are doing 1031s, and I want to know, you know, if they go into a syndication or TIC or partnership, or which is a better structure, and then what do we need to know about placing the 1031 money into a deal?
Well, the 1031 exchange, in order to do it successfully, you've got to keep you got to keep all properties in the same entity. So, say if you've got a property now that is in a trust or an LLC, then you got to keep it in the same LLC as you transfer. If you have it in your own personal name, you should transfer it out of your personal name into a trust or an LLC, and then buy the next property. So for those that aren't familiar with 1031 exchanges, it's a government rule, it's an IRS rule, and it allows you to sell a property, take the profits, and use all of the profits into the next property and not pay taxes. You actually defer the taxes until you have what's called a taxable event. And you can do is keep 1031 and 1031ing, and the benefit is you get a lot more down payment, so you can buy a bigger property. The rules are is that you have to identify your next property within 45 days of selling the property that you're selling, and then you have to close on the next property within 180 days. And there's a lot of other miscellaneous rules as well, but those are the big ones. And do you have to use all of your money going into the next property? The answer is no, but whatever you take out is called boot, B-O-O-T. And you'll be taxed on the boot coming out of the property, but you can take some out and then move the rest of it into that property. And like I said, you can keep buying properties until you close on that last one and decide you're not going to buy another one, then you pay the taxes on all of the gains at that time. Or if you die, the basis of those properties goes right up to the last property that you owned, which means that your family will not pay taxes on your 1031 exchange properties, which is a great thing. But the bad thing is you have to die for them to give them the ability to do that. How's that? How's that for a quick tutorial on 1031s?
That's good. But my question would be, so you mentioned, you know, like personal name, land trust, LLC. So I have people in all those situations. Like a guy, he's selling a property and it's in his own name right now, and he want to put that like $400,000 into a deal. So, and then my property I'm selling is in a land trust with the LLC. And then there, I know another person who owns a property in an LLC. So, like there, so if we were to do a deal together, would that be doable, or we have to do like a deal separately, you know, with one or two people max in a deal when you place the money that's coming from the 1031?
Three people can't sell a property and then put it in, and then all three 1031 into a single property. That doesn't work. You guys can buy a property together and then 1031 out of that property into the next property, because you'd be doing it under the same entity. But no, you can't do that. You can do like multiple properties. You can sell like three or four properties that you have in the same name, and exchange it for one larger property, and vice versa. You could sell one larger property and exchange it into smaller properties as long as they're all in the same name. But yeah, that same name statute, that's what will get you there with your partners. You can't all come, if you haven't been doing business before, you can't all come 1031 exchange into a property together.
I see. So they cannot invest in a project. So they have to be like a sole owner of that new property. Right.
To get deferment of taxes, yes. They don't necessarily need to be a sole owner. I mean, they could. You can have multiple owners, and you know, in reality, you can have multiple owners, and then let's say that two or three people want to be cashed out, and they don't want to go into the next property. Well, you know, one person or several people could go into the next property as long as you keep that same entity name.
Okay. So they have to be in the deal before, like owning together before. So then there's. So you cannot do TIC either?
You don't want to do
like
TIC.
Tenant in common? No? Okay.
Yeah, tenant in common. For those that aren't familiar with tenant in common basically means that you partner with people in majority rules and everybody has a say, and it's the biggest, it will be your worst nightmare. I've done three of them, and I'll never do them again. And when I decided I wasn't going to do them again, about a year or two after, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac decided they weren't ever going to do them again either. They're just a nightmare. We actually lost the property because right before a required refinance, this is back in on the downturn of the market, right before a required finance, one of the partners in a 1031 exchange decided he wasn't going to sign any of the paperwork, knowing that we would lose the property back to the bank. In that short amount of time, it was 93% occupied, but him and his partner had broken up, and he was so mad at the partner, he was willing to, I think he had $100,000 invested in the deal, he had $25,000. Him and his partner put $50,000 and $25,000 each, knowing that not only was he going to lose his $25,000, but his partner was going to lose his $25,000. That's what was going to make him happy. Plus, everybody else lost as well. It was crazy. It's one of the worst things I've ever been through. So don't do a tick. Tenant in common.
Okay. So if they don't want to, you know, actively manage another investment property, so then what is the best, like,
you do a
offer
syndication.
You can give to them?
Yeah, it's just a simple syndication where your operating agreement gives you control of the property.
And then have them invest in the being one of the members of the LLC for
sure.
The syndication?
Yep. They could become a member, non-voting member.
Okay. Oh, I thought you said that's not
allowed. They can't come into that deal and defer their taxes. That was your original question. But they could certainly invest in the deal.
Okay, and they have to pay capital gain for
If they're selling a property and they're investing into a new property, of which you are will be part owner as well, then unless you name it their entity, you know, but unless you actually buy into their entity and then you buy that property through their entity, which you got to be really careful about because you don't know, you know, what type of what's in the past of that entity. People come to me and ask me, should, you know, I can buy the corporation, you know, that's how I'm going to get in. I won't do this. I won't pay taxes on this and that. And I always tell people, don't do that. You don't know what is outstanding. You don't know what type of debt, what legal problems there might be with that particular corporation or entity. And I've said that when I was teaching on stage many, many times. And I actually had a student call me up all upset because she went to a partnership with another student on a deal. And they bought the corporation, and it ended up that the corporation had to declare bankruptcy because of something, something, something. And like, okay, if you just listened, you wouldn't have had this problem. So that's my take on all that.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. All right, thanks.
Good luck. Go to that restaurant.
I'll send what's your brother name? I just forgot his name.
Jeff.
Yeah. I'll let him know the name of the restaurant. He can back it to you.
He knows where it is. I think I've been with him. I'm not sure now. I think he knows where it is. If not, I'll give directions. Okay. I gotta move on.
All right, thanks.
All right, take care. All right, who's next?
Up next we have Adam. Adam, please state your question.
Adam?
Hey, Dave, how are you, man? Thanks for taking the call.
Hey, you're welcome. Hey, a very famous Adam died just the other day. Do you know who it was?
No, who was it?
Adam West. Do you know who he was?
No, no idea.
He was the original Batman.
Oh, really?
Yep. Back when I was a kid, Batman and Robin, the original Batman and Robin was on. Yeah.
Is that when they used to have the Big Bang, pow, all that stuff on the
screen?
Yeah.
That was the good times. And Catwoman was really Catwoman.
That's funny, man.
So
I'm from Denver, and our market is just booming right now. Everybody's asking a premium for their apartments
and
housing.
They all have a premium in Denver.
Yeah, it's crazy right now, and I just didn't know if it was a good idea to invest into Denver or should we move on to somewhere like Albuquerque.
If you're from Denver, I would definitely start investing there, start building a team there, because that market, you know, will move up and down. But you know what? It doesn't matter if it's a high market in Denver. Were you at the boot camp over the weekend?
Yes, sir.
Do you remember me saying that that the Denver sellers are always trying to get premium pricing or higher pricing than the properties are worth? Even in a down market, Denver is one of those rare cities where whenever you enter the market, in a down market or an up market, the sellers are always trying to get way more than the property's worth. Not to say that you can't do well there. I've had students go there and retire in 3 to 5 years that didn't even live there in a down market, and then they wrote it up. You know, and you got Jeff Kissy, who you met over the weekend. He's doing business there. So, no, I think it's a good idea. It's a great market. It has its high highs and low lows, and it moves quickly, so you can profit from each of those. So I would build my team there, but also, you know, with the experience that you get from building your team there and the market, it is, you know, it is higher up in the curve than some of the other markets. But just go to a market like Albuquerque or another market that is that has some more yield to it. I think Albuquerque, though, I think Albuquerque has similar characteristics to Denver. It's a really tight market. I think it's a good market right now, but it's a really tight market. I think maybe if you move over to like St. Louis or Kansas City, more so St. Louis. St. Louis and the Ohio cities like Cleveland I just talked about. There's things happening in Toledo, which I was really surprised to hear. Dayton, Ohio is a good market. You know, markets like that really have started to move really late in the cycle, they'll have a lot more leg room, and they're not as tight as in Albuquerque or Denver.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that. I got one more for you.
Yep.
Do you think that it's smart for our first investment? Do you think that we should try to be our own investors on the first deal, or should we still seek an investor for the first one if we've got a little bit of money saved?
That's up to you, but you know, I've always been under the notion that if I can get someone else to invest in my deal and I can do more deals because of that, then I'd rather do more deals because you get more experience. You learn how to play the game faster, but not only that, if there's always a good deal that's just going to drop. And sometimes it drops so fast and you got to close so fast that you don't have time to get investors into the deal, you know, and you have to go in cash and then maybe bring in investors later if you want to, or just stay in the deal cash. But that's what I always try to save my cash for, is those unexpected deals that come up and they happen fast, and you've got to be in a position to take them down.
Gotcha. No, that makes perfect sense, man. Thank you.
Yep, or you might want to do a much smaller deal and use your own cash, you know, like a three-unit property or a four-unit property. 3 to 6 unit property, use your own cash and get the feeling of putting your systems and team in place to get that first deal done and then move forward, you know, with that confidence and bring your investors into your bigger deals.
Gotcha. No, that makes sense, man. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good luck out there.
All right. Appreciate it. Have a good one.
You too. All right. Who's next?
Up next, we have Stephanie. Stephanie, please state your question.
Hi, Dave. This is Stephanie.
Hi.
Walter. I was at the boot camp in Denver too this weekend.
Excellent.
Thank you. I think my question might be kind of on the basic side, but I'm going to be contacting the commercial brokers, this week, and I haven't ever worked with a commercial broker. All my experience has been with residential ones, and I know that they sort of they specialize in certain areas of Denver, even certain neighborhoods they're in, and they don't know a lot about others.
Yep.
If I contact a commercial broker in Denver, will they have any knowledge or interest in doing deals like in Pueblo or Greeley, or should I contact commercial brokers in those specific areas?
Well, it all depends on the reach of that particular brokerage agency. One of the things I've learned is that when I went into Texas, my first market was Texarkana, Texas, and my partner brought a deal to me that a broker had given to him. It was a rehab. We weren't really looking at that market as an emerging market. It was a short sale. We got it for about $400,000 less than the previous owner had a loan on it for, and it looked like it was a really good deal. And then we started to look at the market. The broker brought another property from that market, and we looked at it, and it cash flowed pretty good. And then I started doing some research in the market and realized that at the time, Texarkana, Texas, was an emerging market, a small emerging market, tertiary market, but it was emerging. A lot of growth going on, a lot of jobs being built. So we bought another one in that market. And then that broker was actually out of Dallas. He was his name was Jordan. I forget what his last name was, but he was out of Apartment Realty Advisors, ARA, which is a pretty good company. And Jordan started bringing us deals from all the different submarkets around Dallas. So we did a deal in Tyler, which is next to Texarkana. We did a deal in Longview. Then we did a deal in Dallas. We ended up dealing a deal in Amarillo and Temple. And what I'm saying is that broker from Dallas was bringing us into all different submarkets, which was great. So if you're with a brokerage company that has a reach out into the submarkets, that's really good. Some of the Atlanta brokers, you know, they have far reaches as well, all the way over to Huntsville, Alabama. You know, you get a lot of Atlanta brokers that service that market. So my first answer is find out what the reach is of the brokerage company. Go with the big ones if you want to have long arms. But number two, I would also, if you're interested in Pueblo, Colorado, I would look for brokers. Usually there's a couple of local brokers that have, you know, a good amount of the listings in that particular market. So you want to find out who those are as well, who the real movers and shakers are on the market. So I would take it down two different ways.
Okay. That sounds good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck out there.
Thank you.
And welcome aboard. All right. Before I take the next question, I just looked down, and there's a question from John Marcos from Dallas, Texas, and he says, I'm attending the UP9. This will be my first Ultimate Partnering event. How do people typically dress? That's a pretty good question. So at that particular event, people dress all different types of ways. You know, it is an event more often where people they're not dressed to the nines, but they're dressed business casual usually. And the reason being, if you're there looking to find money partners, or if you're there looking to find business partners, you want to look smart and successful. You know, you want to look good. If you're there for the education and the other types of networking, maybe building people on your team, you know, you can decide how you want to dress. But most people will dress business casual, and a lot of people will be wearing jackets. A lot of people won't, but a lot of people will. But certainly few people will have ties. But, you know, it's not really a tie event, but it's definitely a business casual event. And by the way, if you just joined us and you want to see that interview that I did with Emmett Smith, that you can go to daveinterview.com, daveinterview.com. And if you didn't, if you're not signed up for Ultimate Partnering 9 and you didn't get it with a package, there's an early bird special that ended last week. If you decide you want to go, you can put in a promo code. And that promo code is DEAL, D-E-A-L, and that will reduce the price that you see on the screen at the end of that interview with Emmett. But that interview was pretty good with Emmett Smith. So let's move on to more questions. Who is the next caller?
Up next, we have Cynthia. Cynthia, please state your question.
Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Dave. This is Cynthia Hurd. My company is Center Management. I'm out of Fort Worth, Texas.
Excellent.
And I can tell you, yeah, it's hot here, no doubt about it.
One thing I learned about having a management company in Texas and owning all those properties, 11 different markets in Texas, is do not go down there from June to September.
Exactly. Nice and warm.
And you
nice
can't fly
warm.
Out. Yeah, there's a thunderstorm every afternoon. You can't fly out. Crazy.
You're right. That's the way it's been the last few weeks. We've had crazy rain here in June, which is just really rare. So it has kept the temperatures down a little bit, which has been nice. So
when that rain comes down so hard and so fast, it comes down sideways, it hurts, catch you on the side of the face. You can't even put up an umbrella, number one. Number two, I think the second or third time I was in Dallas, and I was driving along during one of these huge rainstorms, I saw a car floating along the road on the underpass here. Because it had gotten so deep so fast.
Exactly. It floods our roads, and you do. You see cars floating by, and you can't see. Your windshield wipers just can't even go fast enough to see anybody in front of you. It's pretty crazy.
It's an experience. Yep. So what's going on in your world?
Well, I want to let you know, my partner and I, we did our one-on-one mentoring with Gail, and I have to tell you, that woman is the most amazing person I've ever met. What a blessing to know her now.
She's great. She
did a great job. So got us pretty fired up. So we're real excited about what's coming down the road for us.
Everybody on this call is in Mastery, and most of you have that service. It's called the mentor, the field mentoring. And Gail and we have three different faculty members that do it. Gail and the other two, I can't remember. I can see their faces, but I can't remember the names off the top of my head. Craig.
Well, she was fabulous.
Yeah, Gail, they're all really good, but Gail's a nice lady. So what else is going on?
Well, I started looking at a property just right west of Fort Worth out in Stephenville, where Tarleton University is. Now, this is a small town, about 19,000 people. It's Cowboy City. But it's growing. I mean, it's got a 4.7% growth rate. It's you know, Tarleton now has a presence in downtown Fort Worth. It's associated with Texas A&M. So it's a really growing area. It still is a small town, but there's some student housing available that's come up for sale that I'm really interested in. I know a lot of the downsides of student housing. What are some of those upsides, especially in a small town like this? What are those upsides of student housing?
Well, first of all, what's the population?
The city has about 19,000 people, It is growing. The school has about 13,000. Now, I don't know if that's all included in that.
Wow.
This is 173 units with 334 beds.
Yep.
It was built in 2005, so it's fairly new. They can't, my understanding from some of the reading is they can't get all their students housed on campus. And there's a couple of other apartment complexes nearby, but this is one of the, like, off-campus student housing properties.
Yep, yep.
And they're charging, you know, anywhere from $800 to almost $2,000 for those four-bed, you know, rooms.
Yeah, the upside is you get a lot more rent. And also, in the downturn in the economy, when the market corrects, the student housing is typically doesn't correct that much. So it's a safe haven in a corrected market.
Okay.
Those are the two big upsides. The downsides, you know, if you run it properly and control the students and, you know, do good background checks and have their parents co-sign, you know, the downside is not – They don't tear the places up like you hear about, like Animal House, but you just don't.
Right, okay. And there, I know, with, you know, it's always a short lease. You know, it's kind of that one-year turnaround. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. But you've got to 90% of your tenants typically are going to turn around in 1 month. That's the problem. And you've got to really lease up. If you're not leased up in that 1 month, then you're going to have a problem the rest of the year.
Right. Because they're all going to be coming in and moving out at the same time, you know what I mean? So, I get the downsides, but it is a really growing area. It's close to Fort Worth. So I'll do the numbers, see what it looks like, and see if it works for me.
Well,
I look forward. We're coming to Boston next month, so.
It's going to be a great time.
We'll see you.
It'll be a lot of fun.
I know. We're looking forward to it. If you could provide us with a little cooler weather, would really appreciate it. Thanks.
It will be a little bit cooler, but not that much cooler. That's like the dog days of summer here. Just like everywhere.
Yeah, it's going to be warm. Yeah.
But we'll see.
Well, thank you, Dave. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Who's next?
Up next, we have Rob. Rob, please state your question.
Hey, Dave, it's Rob out in San Diego. How are you doing today?
Hey, Rob, what's going on down there in San Diego?
Well, it's nice and sunny today in the mid-70s. No complaints out here.
Sweet. San Diego's always nice.
Yeah. So thanks for taking my call. I wanted to mention that we have a deal that we closed on in Cincinnati, and we're just trying to wrap up the equity raise. There's a couple spots still available. I know not to talk about specific returns and things, but I wondered if I couldn't just give a broad overview to see if there's any interested investment partners on the line today.
Go right ahead.
All right. It's the property's in the Northgate submarket of Cincinnati. We're really excited about it. We've done a lot of research on the market. There's a lot of job growth, and I know Dave mentioned earlier different markets of Ohio, and this is a market that we've been trying to get into, and we finally broke into closed escrow a couple weeks ago, and we're just trying to wrap up the raise. There's a couple spots still available. It's a 132-unit apartment complex. It's actually a portfolio. 100 of the units were built in 1970, and the other 32 units were built in the early 2000s. They're right across the street from one another, and they're operated out of the same leasing office. The property is fully occupied, above 95%. It has been for the last several years, and there's really strong cash flow. There is a little bit of value add. We're going to be executing an interior renovation program to boost rents, but as of the date that we closed, there was actually some significant loss to lease going on, even without upgrading the units. We did market surveys, visited all our competitors in the market, and determined that without doing anything, the units are actually still below market levels. We feel that that's because the property was being self-managed by the seller. We went in at a 7.6 cap based on the last 12 months of actual P&Ls. And if anyone is interested in learning more of the specific details, I'd encourage you to reach out to me and I can provide you with those. And it's a pretty exciting project. It's got strong cash flow, and you know, our investors are pretty excited about the cash distributions that are forecast.
How'd you find that deal?
It came to us through a broker that we closed on another deal in Indianapolis with first quarter of last year. So we got ourselves and one other group got kind of a first look and a first crack at it, and we were able to secure the contract. So, you know, broker relationships, like Dave mentioned, are invaluable. They can lead you to a lot of off-market properties.
Yeah. Yep. And so how from San Diego did you create that relationship with somebody from Cincinnati?
Well, it started a while ago, just, you know, hammering the phones. We started, per your training, looking for brokers on LoopNet. We weren't necessarily looking for properties on LoopNet because, like you say, they've already been shopped around typically if they're on LoopNet, and it's sort of a last resort. But LoopNet is a great source for finding names and numbers of brokers in a given market. And typically, if they're on LoopNet, they're usually, you know, the movers and shakers in the market. They have a lot of properties. And so we started that way, you know, Google searching different commercial brokerage firms and just making calls. The other way that we did it was, you know, traveling to these markets. So, you know, we go to Indianapolis, we go to Cincinnati. If there's a market that we're interested in investing in, we fly there. I'm actually jumping on a plane tomorrow morning to go to Indianapolis to look at a property that we have under contract scheduled to close in another week or two. So, you know, every time we're in a market, we always do rent comp surveys, and we also try to schedule as many meetings with brokers and key team members as we can to make the best use of our visits.
Good advice, good advice. Everybody that's new that's always wondering how it's done. And they hear us teach it, but it's always good to hear it from someone that's out there doing it as well, like everybody does. Everybody goes through the same process, especially in emerging markets, on getting brokers in your back pocket, you know, going through the calling a whole bunch, getting a few responses, and then from the few responses, weeding them out to find ones that you have commonality that you can do business with, and then eventually a deal pops, and then boom. Then you start advertising to all the other brokers that you just closed this deal, and then they want to know your name, and they want to do some business too, and things start rolling. So the hardest is that first deal, and after that first deal is done, everything starts to get a lot easier. So, all right, good luck. I hope you get some people to take you up on that offer.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, take care. All right, who's next? We got time for I got a 2 o'clock appointment, so we got about 8 more minutes. So who's next?
Up next, we have Mark. Mark, please go ahead.
Hey, Mark.
Hi, Dave. It's Mark Dupuis from Ottawa, Ontario. How you doing?
Good. What's going on?
Things are good. I just got back from a trip in Cincinnati and Louisville. And we're trying to – it's my second time that I've been to Louisville. Mm. And the first time I was there – one of the brokers that we've managed to build a relationship with pitched us these three low-income housing tax credit properties.
Yeah.
When I first looked at them, one of them wasn't even cash flowing. One was making money. The other one was kind of outside of Louisville, a bit too far. I wasn't too worried about that one because it had the it was one of those ones where the vouchers actually went with the property. So he told me, he said, as soon as I get it ready, they start paying regardless if there's somebody in there or not. So that one there was kind of not ideal from a location standpoint, but was good from a cash flow standpoint. But overall, it's just not we're just wasn't meeting the numbers. So when I came around this time, I think the fellow that owns them is just fed up and he just wants to move on. He's been dealing with another property and he got crushed by Exxon on this other property. So he wants out. He just checked out. He just said, look, I'm willing to kind of give these away kind of deal. But I'm still looking at it going, okay, well, this one that doesn't make any money, regardless if you give it to me, it's still not going to get any money. So the broker is really not familiar with the low-income housing tax credits. So I'm trying to figure out what the play is, really. Like, he's almost at the end of his 12-year or 15-year commitment. I'm just wondering if the play is just really to just hold on until that happens and then go to market rent. Is that really my only play on something like that? Or?
I mean, yeah. How? First of all, they get a cash flow in order for you to buy him. But how long before they go to market?
I think he's 2 years out.
Oh wow, that's perfect time to buy.
Yeah, but I don't want to be. I don't want to have a negative cash flow for 2 years.
You're going to have to get it at a price where it's not negative.
Yeah. So I heard you talking on the one of the first calls where you said that when you're talking about Cleveland, you're saying that the way the counties are attracting people is giving them a break on the property tax component. Is that the only piece that they're really getting? Like, they're not getting a grant to build these things from scratch, and they're really into it with no money. It's just the tax component.
If it's a tax credit deal, then it's just a tax component. But in any city that's trying to attract companies, there's four major types of concessions that they make. They'll give away free land. They'll give away free money,
right,
which is the grants. They'll give away low interest loans. They'll give away tax credits.
Right. Okay. So I really got to figure out how to make it cash positive to be able to make sense.
Yeah, that's what you got to do. Do you have to take all three? Yeah. Sounds like two of them were positive, but one of them wasn't.
Yeah, initially he wanted to sell them as a package.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's still on the table. This guy, like I said, I remember at the time that I was there a few months ago, he was talking about this new property that he had, a big property, and something happened with Exxon. Exxon somehow was involved in this, and he was expecting a big payday coming up really shortly, and he was expecting like hundreds of millions of dollars. And I was like, hey, that's great. You know, yeah, that's why I was kind of moving on from these other ones. So when I went back there just last week, I guess his whole expectations from Exxon took a real turn for the worse, and they sold the property that was in his name, and they sold it. And I'm like, okay, I don't know the details, but it doesn't look like it just looked like that project just broke him. And I think that's what's kind of causing him to just want to check out and just don't want anything to do with anything anymore and just get rid of these properties and just I want out. So that's why I'm trying to understand, okay, how do I make this work so that, you know, you want to make it work, I want to make it work, and, you know, we still make money, but on these properties, if I can't make money, then there's no sense in me doing it.
The only other thing you can do, which I don't like to do, is to take a look at all three properties together and see how they cash flow together. And, if you got a windfall with tax credits expiring in 2 years, you know, that might be worth it, but you would have to group them together for your investors as well and show them that type of a plan.
Yep.
But I've been in those situations where I've had they wanted to buy a group of properties, and there's always a couple of dogs in there, and you try to take the dogs out, they won't do it. And most of the time we don't do it. But one time we did, and actually the dog outperformed all the other properties, which is really surprising. And we didn't expect that either. We just were hoping to carry it until we, you know, resold these things. That's the way to look at it. Either you got to buy it at a price that cash flows, or you can take a look at the three deals together, see what type of cash flow they have for the next couple of years, and package them to your investors together as well.
Okay, that's what I'll do. I'll take a look at them that way.
All right, good luck.
Perfect. Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome. All right, we have time for one more. Who's going to be at 1 minute of the hour?
Up next, we have another Rob on the line. Rob, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave, what are the chances of having two Robs from sunny San Diego? I think we all need to go play the lottery.
I don't know. I know. That's, we should. What numbers would
we play? I don't know. So I was wondering to piggyback on Christy's question having to do with the 1031 exchange into a syndicated deal. I was under the impression that to satisfy the 1031 requirements, and I think you already mentioned this, the name of the entity has to be, ends up with the property has to be the same as the entity that relinquished the property.
Yeah.
And that was the whole reason for doing a tenant in common, so that their portion of the tenants in common would be the same entity. Is there a way to do it differently than that?
To go into the next deal of the, oh, I see what you're saying. You know, I'm not familiar with that strategy. I've used Starker Services in the past, or Chicago Title, and I meant to refer her as well. Both of those organizations can answer that question. Now that you're saying it that way, now I see what she was trying to tell me. But yeah, I'm not familiar with that strategy. She should call me there.
Yeah, the only reason why, because I'm going through the same thing myself right now, and the only reason why we're considering a tenant in common, and we are getting counsel from the 1031 accommodator, that it would, the only way to do it is with, you know, an agreement. You'd have somebody like Kim Taylor or Gene Trowbridge write up a tenant in common agreement, and you would have to have your portion still owned by that same entity that relinquished the property on the other end.
Right.
So anyways, that's number one. Number two, I'll give them a call and just confirm, see if there's any other way to do it after hearing your story about the tenants in common.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, you got to take a look at the risk. The risk versus reward, you know?
Yep. And then next question.
Yep.
I am 1031-ing in this situation into a syndicated deal. I am being asked to be the sponsor on the deal, as well as the portion that I'm 1031-ing in is a fairly large part of the raise. What is so I will be on the management side as well. What is the fair request of the carve out to be playing that role?
Of the company dollar, it can range anywhere from 10% to 50%. Of what you can negotiate. I think the standard is about 25% of company dollar.
And what do you mean by company dollar?
With the term, for those of you unfamiliar with the term company dollar, if your investors, if it's a 75-25 split, the investors are getting 75% of the cash flow in equity and you're getting 25% of the cash flow in equity, I call that company dollar. That's the company dollar side. So of that amount, the typical is about 25% of that equity in cash flow.
I see. Okay. Okay, well, that's fantastic. Good information. And last question, I don't know, did you ever receive, when I went to the syndication boot camp in Orlando as a refresher a few months back, I gave a book to Jeannie with myself and Brian Tracy on the cover. I want to make sure you got that.
What was it called?
It was called The Business. The Success Blueprint.
Yes. I did get that. I'm looking around my office for it. But I did get that. I remember that. It was on my desk for a while.
Good deal.
I put it in my bookcase. Thank you very much for that book. I appreciate it.
You bet. You know, I wrote that with a number of other authors. Flip to my chapter and read the first paragraph. I think you'll get a kick out of it.
All right. I will. I'll look for that on my bookshelf.
Okay, guy. Thank you for your
time,
Dave.
Okay, take care. Thanks. All right, so you know your homework, mastery students, is to go out there and get in two offers. Put in two offers. They don't have to be good deals. Just get on LoopNet, get somewhere else, and analyze a deal. Use the script that you got at the boot camp on how to present a low-ball offer with the intent of getting other deals, not that particular one, in a relationship with a broker. So put in two offers and get yourself into two networking situations, whether they be business, whether they be social, something. Summer's here. You know, cookouts are happening. Great times to raise private money. So two and two. Two offers, two networking situations, and you will be successful. It's just as simple as that. But you got to do it. All right. We will see you actually next week. I'll be on because this week was supposed to be a live stream call with a bunch of other people that could watch but not participate. And the technology broke down at the last minute. So I will be on live next week myself to answer some more questions from you guys. And then the week after that, it will be Electric Grill Genie. So I'll see you guys next week. Have a great week.